You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Wow, what happened to the holidays? And here it is, the eve of the new year, ready for us to start breaking resolutions left and right. As we listen to our passage from Matthew today, it's good to remember some of the often overlooked elements of the birth narratives that we normally just blow through at Christmas time. So, to help give us some context, let's remember that it's only Matthew who tells us the story of a star and wise men, while Luke spins a tale of angels and shepherds. In Luke, Joseph, Mary, and Jesus are refugees from Nazareth, making do in Bethlehem. But in Matthew, they have a house in Bethlehem and only move to Nazareth after they flee to Egypt. That way, Matthew and Luke each fulfills the predictions that Jesus would be born in Bethlehem, but be called a Nazarene, but with very different plot lines. So, if you're not clear already, it's good to remind yourself that when revisiting these Christmas stories, we're not dealing with history, but parable. When you read the text of Matthew with the knowledge that Matthew is setting Jesus up to be the new Moses, bound to set his people free, the story today makes perfect sense. Moses escaped Pharaoh's massacre of Hebrew babies, so Jesus has to as well, although Matthew casts Herod as much worse than Pharaoh, because Pharaoh only ordered all the boy babies killed. Herod ordered all babies killed. Moses, of course, comes out of Egypt and brought the people a new law. Jesus, too, came out of Egypt and brought the people a new way of life. Woven into these stories are expressions of the hope that even in the dark of winter, under the heel of oppression, left without resources, we are not alone in the universe. At least we're not like Joseph, being directed by angels every time we turn around. The poor guy couldn't get a good night's sleep. Let's listen in.
Our words of wisdom are from Matthew chapter 2, verses 13 through 15 and 19 through 23.
Now, after the wise man had left, and an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said,
"Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him."
Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and they went to Egypt and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet.
"Out of Egypt I have called my son."
When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said,
"Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel, for those who are seeking the child's life are dead."
Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. When he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judea in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there.
And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. And there he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled.
"He will be called a Nazarene."
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
Some of you might remember way back to 2013 when we had the privilege of hosting Jim and Jean Strathdy here at the Fountains. To open our celebration today, we sang their "I Am the Light of the World." Jim was inspired to write the music to the words of Methodist mystic Dr. Howard Thurman. Thurman was an influential author, philosopher, theologian, educator, and civil rights leader. He was Dean of Theology and Dean of the Chapels at both Howard University and Boston University for more than two decades. He wrote 20 books, taught Martin Luther King Jr. about the nonviolence of Mahatma Gandhi, and in 1944 helped found the first racially integrated multicultural church in the United States. In his poem, The Work of Christmas, Thurman reminds us why the real work of Christmas is a year-round enterprise. When the song of the angels is stilled, when the star in the sky is gone, when the kings and princes are home, when the shepherds are back with their flock, the work of Christmas begins. To find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among all, to make music in the heart. Well, now that Christmas is behind us, there's one more thing to do before we get back into the everyday grind. As we stand on the threshold of a new year, most of us resolve to go about one thing or another differently. One of the things that I continue to strive for as a resolution is the ability to truly understand other people's situations without my prejudices or jaded perspective or naivete tainting my journey and causing me to be less than what I know I'm called to do and be. One of my favorite stories is from Stephen Covey, author of the bestseller, The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. In it, he tells of an encounter on a subway in New York one morning. People were sitting quietly, reading newspapers, lost in thought, or resting their eyes. At the next station, a man and his children entered the subway car. The children were so loud and rambunctious that instantly the whole climate in the car changed. The man sat down next to Covey and closed his eyes, apparently oblivious to the situation. The children were yelling back and forth, throwing things, even grabbing people's papers. It was very disturbing. And yet the man next to Covey did nothing. It was difficult not to feel irritated. How could this man be so insensitive as to let his children run wild like that and do nothing about it, taking no responsibility at all? It was easy to see that everyone else on the subway felt irritated too. Finally, with as much patience and restraint as he could muster, Covey turned to the man and said, "Sir, your children are really disturbing a lot of people. I wonder if you couldn't control them a little more." The man lifted his gaze as if to come to a consciousness of the situation for the first time and said softly, "Oh, you're right. I guess I should do something about it. We just came from the hospital where their mother died about an hour ago. I don't know what to think, and I guess they don't know how to handle it either." Covey was stunned. He asks, "Can you imagine how I felt at that moment?" His understanding shifted. He relates, "Suddenly I saw things differently. And because I saw differently, I thought differently. I felt differently. I behaved differently. My irritation vanished. My heart was filled with the man's pain. Feelings of sympathy and compassion flowed freely. 'Your wife just died? I am so sorry. Can you tell me about it? What can I do to help?' Everything changed in an instant." When the work of Christmas begins, it would be good to also remember these words from T.S. Eliot. There's always something we're ignorant of about another person. And often it turns out that the one thing we're ignorant of about another person was the most important. Marcus Borg used to say that it's the smallest, most intimate one-on-ones with other human beings that really become the acid test for our faith. Can we make the virtue of compassion our way of life? Creative, healing, paying attentioning, compassion to find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among all, to make music in the heart, to see another person, even a stranger, as a sister or brother, is the kind of resolution that I can buy into. The embracing of what Jesus preached and practiced as the primary quality of a life centered in the mystery of the divine. Unfortunately, this kind of resolution has taken a beating of late. It seems like the priority for a frighteningly large percentage of our fellow citizens is to not only not see other people, even strangers, as sisters and brothers, but to look at them with suspicion and mistrust. And the sad part is that many people advocating this kind of suspicion and mistrust are Christians. Why? Because they've been convinced that being a true Christian is about following a bunch of rules and knowing what hoops they have to jump through in order to be loved and accepted. Making awareness a priority, an awareness of the concerns and pain of others, couldn't be further from many so-called Christians' minds. It's like they gather together to be whipped into a lather by their pastors over who to hate, who's ruining the country, and who's doing immoral things, all the while being oblivious to their own failure to do the one thing that Jesus asked them to do: love your neighbor as yourself. And remember, it's not love your neighbor as you love yourself. No! People use that misquote as an excuse all the time. Oh, I'll love them once I can work out loving myself. God help us, no! The Leviticus passage Jesus quotes says very specifically, love your neighbor as yourself. In other words, as though they are an extension of your very being. As one of my rabbi mentors, Rami Shapiro, asks, you don't let yourself go hungry, do you? You don't sleep out on the street? You don't let the system lock you up unjustly because of your race or socioeconomic status? You don't let the government take your children away from you because you weren't born in the right place or have the right paperwork, do you? If we were genuinely doing what Jesus asked us to do, we would be rising up and calling out our religious and political leaders for not doing more to care for the poor, the mentally ill, the refugee, and the marginalized among us. But we've got an uphill battle on two fronts. First off is what's called the attention economy. Even if you haven't heard of it, you've been being manipulated by it. The attention economy is the understanding that your attention is a commodity that advertisers and influencers can take advantage of for their own benefit. It's not bad enough that our phones have a stranglehold on most of our attention anymore. Have you been to a gas station recently? Many of the pumps now have little TVs that play advertisements and frantic infomercials very loudly while you're pumping your gas. You can't get away from the marketers and advertisers trying to monetize every square inch and every spare moment of our lives. But what may be worse are the principalities and powers who are manipulating others not for money, but to secure their own power in the world. They are counting on us remaining distracted and ignorant of one another's circumstances and needs. That way, fear and suspicion can be leveraged to keep people apart. It starts with controlling the narrative, beginning with things like our Christmas stories. I cannot tell you how many people have stomped off in righteous indignation when I've simply pointed out that there are two different Christmas stories that don't match. Somehow, I'm the evil heretic for pointing out what we've already talked about today, that in Matthew's story, the family had never lived in Nazareth and actually had a house in Bethlehem. God forbid if I bring up parallels with today that, according to the text, the Holy Family were refugees or political asylum seekers in a foreign country. But how is their escaping to another country in order to avoid being killed by a death squad not parallel to what many are going through right now? Never mind that the leading presidential candidate for one party is simultaneously accusing immigrants of being evil and poisoning the blood of our country, while at the same time having been married to two immigrants whose children are apparently poisoning the blood of our country. But because the attention economy has maxed out people's capacity for awareness, they fail to see the inconsistency, the racism, and the manipulation. One last example. Right now, the continuing war between Israel and Hamas is depending on people's incapacity to pay attention. Somehow, criticizing the Israeli government on their extreme tactics and the killing of innocent civilians has become to many akin to anti-Semitism, while at the same time, innocent Palestinians are dehumanized and discounted. And one of the major background reasons for all of this is evangelical Christianity's unquestioning support of Israel. But not for any moral reason. It's a callous means to an end. Evangelicals believe that certain things have to happen in Israel, like the temple being rebuilt, before Jesus can come again. This results in unquestioning support of Israel as a necessity for their narrow interpretation of the Bible to come true. Never mind that, in the evangelical scenario, when Jesus does return, guess what Jesus is going to do? First thing, kill all the Jews for not believing in Jesus. Yeah, you don't hear them talking about that little detail too much. And people are so worn out being distracted by all the noise, we end up being ignorant of that one thing about another person or situation that is the most important. So, as we head into 2024, let's not be tempted to hunker down in our insulated bunkers and isolate ourselves from reality. If we're going to be on about the work of Christmas that Howard Thurman has set before us, we can't be like my grandfather, who used to throw up his hands in indifference and say, if it's not one thing, it's the same thing. No, we need to embrace that T.S. Eliot sentiment of it's always something. There's always something we're ignorant of about another person or situation, and often it turns out that that one thing we're ignorant of is the most important. You may not have known that for Matthew, Jesus is the new Moses. But now that you do, you won't be able to read Matthew without stumbling upon all these gems of literary creativity where Matthew tells us something really important about Jesus that we would otherwise be ignorant of. It's always something, and we have to be intentional to overcome the religious inertia, the political exploitation, and the manipulators of the attention economy to not be ignorant of whatever that something is. But when we do strive to be on about the work of Christmas, to find the lost, to heal the broken, to feed the hungry, to release the prisoner, to rebuild the nations, to bring peace among all, and to make music in the heart. When we take to heart Ezekiel's sentiment, O God, give us hearts of flesh to replace our hearts of stone, we make real what Jesus called us to be on about in the world. Many years ago, author and pastor Robert Raines penned a prayer that Jeff Proctor Murphy and I adapted for a Living the Questions series. Especially at this time of year, I can't imagine a better sentiment for those of us who are striving to find that one something that we're ignorant of that could potentially make all the difference in the world. Be well.
Ezekiel had it right. Oh God, give us hearts of flesh to replace our hearts of stone.
Both Hebrew and Christian scripture are thick with reminders to go beyond being open, even to those who seem unlovable, to being open especially to those who seem unlovable or who are excluded for whatever reason.
Oh God, make me discontented with things the way they are in the world and in my own life.
Make me notice the stains when people get spilled on. Make me care about the slum child downtown, the misfit at work,
the people cramped into the mental hospital, the men, the women, the youth behind bars.
Jar my complacence. Expose the excuses. Get me involved in the life of my city and world. Give me integrity once more.
Give me integrity once more, O God, as we seek to be changed and transformed with a new understanding and awareness of our common humanity.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.